From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. They are just like you, and we are very thankful for you and for all of them. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, the Baha'i World Religion Day begins at sundown on January 17th, and Sunday the 18th marks the start of a week of prayer for Christian unity. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief radio show.
Il est 17h14. La colonne d'assaut des hommes du raid est lancée.
Dressed in black, masked, determined, cradling their weapons, the gunmen look like seasoned veterans who stepped right off the battlefields of Iraq, Syria, or Yemen.
This is an opportunity for government, religious leaders, and the media to come together and show that a unified response is what is needed. Otherwise, divisiveness, that just means at the end of the day, the terrorists have won.
Last week, bloody attacks on innocent civilians in Paris galvanized the world's attention and the world's fears. Some truly irresponsible and even stupid things have been said in the intervening days. But there have also been words of insight and even wisdom. In the pages of Religion Dispatches magazine, Mark Juergensmeyer made the simple but essential statement that, quote, religion was not the reason for the Paris attacks. On this week's show, I welcome Mark back to expand on that statement, because it is this simple truth that determines every single thing we do next to fight terrorism around the globe.
On Monday, 25,000 people took the streets of Dresden for a rally organized by a group called Pegida. It's a German acronym that translates in English to Patriotic Europeans Against the Islamization of the West. Counter demonstrations against Pegida in Germany over the weekend and Monday attracted more than 100,000 people, but an anti-Islamic nationalist movement is undeniably on the rise, not just in Germany, but across Europe.
Falling into the category of stupid, as well as profoundly dangerous, is the rapidly growing anti-Muslim fervor rampaging across Europe as the major response to the Paris bloodbath. As much as we worry about expressions of misguided anti-Islamic hatred in the U.S., Germany has seen tens of thousands of people taking to the streets in opposition to immigration and refugee policies in that country. Now, the hate movement called Pegida is poised to expand to the UK, Switzerland, and beyond. State of Belief producer Ray Kirstein is in Germany and participated in the largest anti-Pegida march in support of tolerance, which rallied 30,000 people in the city of Leipzig last Monday. We'll be talking with Ray about that event. But first,
I still have a dream.
A black woman with six children told us, if Darren Wilson doesn't get indicted, it means my children have no future.
I have a dream.
The protests over the case have been snowballing in dozens of cities on the East and West Coast.
Lines of riot police with heavy-duty riot vehicles.
As much as a national discussion on race in this country dominated headlines late in 2014, the inevitable fickleness of the news cycle has caused a shift in media attention in recent days. Monday, as most of you know, is the National Martin Luther King Jr. Day observance, and on today's show, I'd like to examine the widespread activism that continues across the country, despite fewer TV cameras, with the goal being nothing less than a more full implementation of Dr. King's dream for African Americans and for all people. Joining me is Pastor Mike McBride, head of the Lifelines to Healing campaign, part of the PICO network. Pastor Mike, I'm really pleased to welcome you back to State of Belief Radio.
Great to be here with you, Rev. Thanks for always having me back.
There's less coverage, but what is the reality on the ground?
The move movement for justice, particularly racial justice, particularly, even more specifically, the full inclusion of black folks into the constitutional promises of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is always an ongoing enterprise. And certainly the issue that actually started, you know, for this generation, I think, with the Trayvon Martin decisions, the Jordan Davis's decisions, the Renisha McBride decisions, and certainly the tragedies of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Ayanna Jones out of Detroit. I think a lot of these instances are now coalescing to create a very public expression of a simmering but very passionate and palpable cry and declaration for justice. And even though the media has tended to go away, the truth is people are still very much working every day, doing direct action, doing training, sitting in city council meetings and state legislatures and congressional offices, all continuing to push towards structural reform and making sure that our lives are meaningful, our lives are valuable, and injustice is addressed. So I know for a fact that it is still very much alive, and it's not going anywhere. It's going to be here for quite some time.
Mike, I agree with you entirely about the pervasiveness and the persistence of the issue, and I recognize that where you work, you see those kinds of actions being taken every day, for which I am grateful. I have to say, though, that I also move in circles in which I find it disappointing in regard to racial justice. It's almost as if we move from crisis to crisis, and media show up when there is a big story, and then that fades away, and you and the people that you mentioned take care of doing business dealing with racial justice, but you don't have the attention and the support of people that need to be paying attention and offering support. How do we get out of that?
Well, I think Dr. King says it best, right? One of his, I think, most important reflections, he says, I've reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the Ku Klux Klaner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice.
Yeah.
And I think that part of what our challenge continues to be is how do we get progressives who claim to be the champions of the poor, the downtrodden, all folks who are living on the margins, to actually really integrate racial justice and the plight of black folk, the plight of poor brown folk and other folks into an agenda that is not just responsive to crisis. I think the direct actions that have been used as a direct result of these injustices in Ferguson and New York and Cleveland and elsewhere are precisely being used as a way to not just challenge those who may have a more conservative ideological or political bent, but it is actually to try and galvanize our progressive allies, our white brothers and sisters, our elected officials, and even some of our own community members from the black community and the brown community to make this a everyday reality and fight. I continue to believe that it is very much easier to respond to the macro aggressions of racism as they make themselves available, the police brutality cases, the vigilante justice cases, the kinds of cases that may involve, you know, very explicit, challenging forms of racism. It's very easy to respond to those, to the microaggressions of racism, which I think many of us can be complicit in every day due to our participation in the structures and the system. So it is important, I think, for all of us to take a look at the things that are happening right in their local community and get engaged and involved. A movement is only as powerful as the people in local communities who are willing to get involved. And we're seeing that in Philadelphia, in Oakland, in Miami, Florida, in New York, in New Orleans, in Texas, all across the country. And we just need people to make sure that this is going to be a priority for them moving forward, or the movement will continue to be crisis-driven, particularly because that's when the media only shows up.
Mike, what are the nitty-gritty issues, the specifics in Dr. King's discussions related to the struggle for justice that we need to be paying attention to every day, as you've just mentioned, and moving beyond just saying we need to be talking more about racial justice. What are the nitty-gritty issues we need to be talking about?
So let's just pull Dr. King's one of his last speeches. He says that the three enemies of the soul, if you will, the American soul, are racism, militarism, and materialism. And if you unpack those three, I think it would be a wonderful starting point for all of us. If you think of racism not as a series of interpersonal slights that are grounded in people's prejudice or bias, but if we think of racism as a structure of exclusion based on people's skin color and often their socioeconomic status and background, then we can begin to look at the structures of our country that are actually perpetuating the kind of alienation and isolation. Racism manifested in the criminal justice system, racism manifested in our public school system, racism manifested in our inability to build wealth due to the ways in which banks and financial institutions continue to discriminate. Mm-hmm. Racism in the way that the job market works when those who are trying to come back home from prison cannot get a job because they continue to have to disclose that they are a felon. Racism in the way that voter suppression is working. If you think of materialism, we can talk about the ways in which military and policing continues to be a occupying force, more than a force of good and peacemaking in the world. All the millions and millions of dollars that are spent to build bombs and planes and tanks and now bringing drones and all these things into our communities, those millions of dollars are being taken away then from schools and from infrastructure and from making sure that our communities have after-school programs, have feeding programs. Militarism is not just about the aggression that is certainly unethical and immoral abroad, but it is also about the financial cost and waste that is also manifesting itself both here domestically and internationally. And then finally, materialism. What does it mean for us to take seriously that the way we use and spend our resources and our money is a direct reflection of our morals and our values? How do we create our budgets in ways that reflect the prioritization of people and not interests? How do we make sure that even in our own personal spending, our own personal choices of how we use our commerce and our revenue, that we're not just continuing to be distracted and caught into an idolatrous stance around just acquiring things? I think those three things, again, focusing on the legacy of Dr. King, allows us to have a starting point that is very concrete: racism, militarism, and materialism. And if we take a look in the mirror, I think all of us can then take some personal responsibility that should then translate to social responsibility, government responsibility, and then global responsibility.
You know, Mike, what I'm weary of, and I know you are too, are people who can say, oh, look, we are for justice, but justice is a big enough and now ambiguous enough term that they can be for justice and not take seriously any of what you've just mentioned. And I think those very detailed, specific issues and responsibilities are where we've got to focus to be sure people understand.
My contention to my congregation and to many of the folks in our Live Free Lifelines campaign work and our Black Lives Matter and Ferguson movement is we have to make sure that our justice movement isn't just us, right?
Right.
Or we are reinscribing the very individuality of this kind of failed postmodern ideological post-enlightenment experience, that justice has to be inclusive of all of us, and it has to make sure that we are indeed being very serious about the ways in which justice impacts not just a few people, but everyone.
Yeah.
And in this way, Dr. King again talks about how justice is a requirement. It is love lived out in the public space. And
right.
I hope we all take the challenge to actually be honest about what our interests are in this intersection between justice and public love.
Tell us what PICO is planning around Martin Luther King Day this year.
So we are making a concerted effort to continue the momentum that has been coming from the coalescing efforts of young people, faith leaders, and clergy all across the country. One of our great examples of this is in Philadelphia. There's going to be a big march respecting almost 10,000 or so folks to join a Reclaim the Dream march that is happening in Philadelphia on Monday. They're going to have an emphasis on improving the public schools, making sure there's police accountability, and jobs here in the Bay Area. There's going to be a big clergy march and a Black Lives Matter-led march and demonstration to address jobs and opportunity pathways. There are marches happening in New York, happening in Kansas City, happening all across the country. And we believe that there's a great opportunity for all of us every time we wake up to make a decision to be a freedom fighter. As Dr. King says, be known as someone who is a drum major for justice. So you can visit our website, livefreeusa.org, or you can go to FergusonAction.com, which is a wonderful collaborative space whereby you'll find all kinds of actions and MLK-focused events that will be happening in your local city. And we look forward to seeing everyone, every person of faith and goodwill, joining us as we stay in the street to reclaim the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King.
I'd like for you to tell our listeners what any one of our listeners could do, anybody, anywhere, in any context could do that would pay dividends in the future.
First thing I would say is submit to the mighty power and love of God, our Creator, who will teach us then how to love one another in ways that are nonviolent. So what does it mean every day to wake up and humble ourselves and ask our Creator to give us the strength to love and the strength to be nonviolent in our interactions and our dealings with one another? And that may sound like a very sappy thing, but I have found it is powerful and transformative. And then the second thing is to make a commitment every day to push back against the structures of racism, materialism, and militarism as they manifest in your local community. It is very apparent all around us. All we have to do is open up our eyes. So those two things, I think, would be very easily accessible for the courageous heart and the willing person. Submit to the power and the love of God and ask God to give us the strength to love one another, and then make a commitment every day to resist the structural racism, the structural militarism, and the structural materialism that is pervasive in our local, state, and national, and dare I say, global community.
Pastor Mike McBride leads the Lifelines to Healing campaign, part of the PICO network. Mike, it's always great to have you on State of Belief Radio. I hope you have a great weekend and a great King Day, and I join you and our listeners with hopes that when this comes around a year from now, we'll be an awful lot better off than we are today.
Amen. Thank you, Brother Wilson. Have a great day as well. Weekend. Kleiner Satellit.
Our longtime producer, Ray Kirstein, currently makes his home in Leipzig, Germany. Does that surprise you? It blows my mind, but I'm not a technological wizard. Ordinarily, modern technology makes it easy to forget that Ray's an ocean away from me. But occasionally, there's also a benefit to having a foreign office for State of Belief Radio. Such was the case this past Monday, as tens of thousands of people took to the streets of German cities in a demonstration of support for the country's immigration and refugee policies. The setting for these marches was a growing and, I must say, frightening movement in opposition to Germany's tolerant policies built on an unsettling wave of anti-Islamic fervor. The nationalistic movement is centered on the formerly East German city of Dresden, where weekly anti-immigrant marches have swelled into the tens of thousands. For a first-hand account of Monday's march in Leipzig with 30,000 in attendance, I'm joined now by Ray Kirstein from Germany. Ray, welcome to State of Belief.
Thanks, Welton. It's good to be here.
Tell me what it felt like on Monday night to see all of those people in the streets of Leipzig knowing what was at stake in the emotions and interests of these people.
You know, in all honesty, it was mixed emotions, both for me and for a lot of folks that I talked to that night. Obviously, Germany is a place that is incredibly careful to suppress any expression of anti-Semitism. At the same time, you have this 3-month-old movement to respond to perceived Islamization, some of the rhetoric that's familiar in the United States, but expressed in a much more visible way with weekly marches in Dresden that started with a couple of hundred, a group called Pegida, and growing to, I believe it was around 18,000 right around Christmas time. Once the attacks in Paris happened, that was used to, you know, hype the concerns about Muslim immigration even more, and the numbers swelled even greater. What's been in the press from this past Monday was that 100,000 people nationwide marched in opposition to the racist marches, but a number of cities, including Dresden, where all this sort of began, swelled to over 20,000. There was a smaller action in Berlin, and the Chancellor Angela Merkel stepped out to be a part of that on Monday. But overall, it's just this sense that it's gratifying to have so many people be out in the streets for tolerance, but it's pretty shocking that it's even needed.
Ray, was this interest in immigration primarily prompted by thoughts of more Muslims coming to Germany?
That's the way that they talk about it, the organizers of the anti-Muslim rallies. They talk about Islamization of Europe. They talk about being overwhelmed, although in Dresden, the statistics are a 0.01% Muslim population. So it's definitely playing on people's fears. It's playing on people's economic concerns. But there's no way that it's backed up even by statistics of the number of immigrants and refugees present, never mind any problems that might be taking place among different groups.
Well, as I understand it, the numbers are growing of both pro and anti-immigrant rallies across the country. You've already intimated some of this, but what are some of the numbers?
The last march in Dresden this past Monday was 25,000 people. The numbers are a little bit smaller, but there have been thousands in other parts of Germany. Frankly, some of the cities in the West where this has in the last couple of weeks tried to take off have seen dismal turnout, which is kind of encouraging. At the same time, since the events in Paris, there have been lots of news reports about the founding of Pegida chapters in the United Kingdom, also in Switzerland, just this past week. So there's really no telling how much hostility and racism and fear and hatred is being tapped into by this movement, but it really is frightening to see the potential of it further even than Germany.
Ray, I want you to do something for me. When you were out in the streets in Leipzig, I want you to imagine that you had a camera in your hand and you took pictures of some of the most memorable sights that you had and the feelings that accompanied that. Tell us what those pictures were.
It would be a very colorful album. There were brave and serious and grim slogans, both English and German, on posters. There were some of the cartoons that have been published since the Charlie Hebdo tragedy that people had blown up and posted onto their signboards. Not the original cartoons, but cartoons that have been on websites in response to the massacre, in opposition to specifically the group Pegida trying to leverage that attack. That went so far as to have some signs quoting the surviving staffers of Charlie Hebdo, saying we absolutely reject everything that Pegida is trying to do and the way they're trying to use the deaths of our colleagues to do it. There were families. The University of Leipzig actually closed early, closed at 3 p.m. on Monday to allow all students and faculty to participate. And that sort of support at the government level, at company level, at the university level shows the degree of commitment organizations, organized parts of the city had in supporting the anti-racism protests. One unforgettable snapshot was a tiny voice next to us as we were in a very large crowd slowly marching through the streets and in the darkness and in the light rain drizzle that was shouting something. And at first I thought it was a small child complaining to his mother having been brought out in the rain. But in fact, it was a little boy, maybe 3 or 4 years old, who was shouting in German, I am Charlie.
Did you see anger?
There was a moment that there was rumor that members of the Pegida rally, which, by the way, numbered about 2,500 in Leipzig as opposed to 35,000 who were against racism, that maybe a part of that group had, they were kept separate, they're in different parts of the city, but that somehow that had come close to the anti-racism rally. And then there was a very loud, concerted, angry shouting, "Nazis raus, Nazis raus," which means "Nazis get out, Nazis get out," from absolutely every voice in our crowd. Other than that, it was less than a party atmosphere, but it was a feeling of solidarity and resolve that was incredibly energizing. And it's going to take every bit of that energy to make sure that the anti-racism movement continues to be strong in Germany and across Europe.
Ray, how did the Charlie Hebdo massacre influence the atmosphere in the streets of Leipzig?
Mostly, I think there was a feeling of outrage that the Pegida anti-Islamic activists had insisted everybody participating in their marches wear a black armband in support of and solidarity with the victims of the Paris massacre. Again, there was an overwhelming sense that that was a misappropriation of that bloodshed for a cause that none of the victims would ever have agreed with.
Will these marches continue? Is that the plan?
Every Monday from here until who knows when, the plan is to have anti-racism marches in Leipzig. And there are certainly plans to have anti-Islam marches in cities across Germany as well. So time will tell, but it really is going to be a struggle of wills, even as the authorities and the government clearly wants to encourage people to be supportive of policies that are very open and are very sensitive to the desperate need of refugees from parts of the world that are much closer to Germany than to the United States, which is the reason that Germany is the number one recipient of refugees from Muslim countries in Europe.
Ray, I realize that in many ways you are a citizen of the world with international sympathies and identifications. But I also know that you are a very patriotic American. I'm curious as to what you felt as being an American citizen participating in that particular demonstration that had to do with what happens in Germany.
To be perfectly honest, Welton, there have been more than several moments over the past 2 years that looking at headlines, even putting things together for this show in the United States, there have been moments where I felt gratitude to be here. There are times that this felt like perhaps a more tolerant, a more sophisticated place. And I say that with all due respect to the U.S. There are just moments that it was like, I'm fortunate to be here. And this was a wake-up call. This was one of those days, Monday, when I thought, there is nowhere to hide. We have a responsibility to be a part of global demands for justice and global opposition to racism and hatred. In a way, it was frightening, but in a way, it's simply a continuation, I think, of the kind of conscious-driven life that one aspires to in one's bravest moments. And it's disappointing at a very, very deep level, but at the same time, I guess it just feels like there's nothing foreign about this particular struggle.
Ray Kirstein is producer for State of Belief Radio. You don't know how appreciative I am that I can make that statement. Originally, Ray relocated to Germany as a DOMA refugee. He continues to make his home in Leipzig with his longtime partner, Yuri. And I thank you for carrying the banner for Interfaith Alliance in Europe.
Thank you very much, Welton.
We've turned to Dr. Mark Juergensmeyer more than once in the aftermath of acts of terror that were cloaked in the language of religion. With Paris still reeling from the most recent attacks, it's important to spend a few minutes with the man who, in the pages of Religion Dispatches magazine, makes the assertion that religion was not the reason for the Paris attacks. Mark, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
My pleasure.
The brutal attacks on the satire magazine Charlie Hebdo, as well as the kosher market in Paris, have brought out a lot of the usual suspects in the U.S. and worldwide to loudly blame Islam for what has happened. We know they're wrong, but you distill the argument particularly well in your Religion Dispatches piece. Did you respond immediately to this? Is that this is kind of a natural reaction, I suppose, from you?
Well, yes and no. I'm trying to be a scholar, and what scholars try to do is to be dispassionate and to try to look at things as objectively as possible. And all my career, I've been interested in the relationship of religion and public life. Maybe this goes back to my Protestant roots in Southern Illinois. I don't know. But I try to understand what religion has to do with things that may be tainted with religious language or identity or whatever. But when you look more closely, they often become much more complicated than that. And this immediately struck me as a case in point, because we've had a whole rash of incidents where, from the attack on the Sikh Gurdwara to the attack on in Oslo, Norway, to on a camp of young youth leaders by Christian terrorists who identified by their religion. But when you look more closely, you see a very complicated picture. And that's what began to emerge here. Now, all the facts are not in, and I'm not claiming to make a definitive statement. All I'm saying is that a knee-jerk reaction that, oh, gee, somebody shot somebody in the name of Islam, well, that darn religion must be, you know, doing it again. Well, first of all, religions don't do anything. People do things. And they do things sometimes out of religious motives, sometimes out of political motives, sometimes out of social motives, sometimes out of complex psychological motives, and sometimes motivations that are mixtures of all of those things. And in this case, what we have is a couple, the two central guys, the brothers, were from an Algerian immigrant community, orphans. They grew up in a rough circumstance. These are guys who grew up as petty thieves, as in trouble with the law from the get-go, a kind of lost souls. You know, the most stable job that one of them had was as a pizza delivery man. But they're clearly looking for stuff in life, angry at life, like a lot of people who have lost their way, wanting to blame somebody else for the misfortunes that they have. And part of a community that feels in a country where multiculturalism has not worked as well as it should, in France, where the Algerian Muslim community already feels alienated, already feels marginalized. It's easily see how they might want to do something. They might want to lash out violently for reasons that are personal, that because of their own, you know, desperate, dead-end, no-end kind of life.
Yeah.
Want to lash out in a violent way. And here, this ideology of extreme, extreme Islamic radicalism seems to give them a way out. It gives them a war. It gives them an opportunity to show those guys, we're going to show that we're tough people. We're going to show that we're somebody.
Yeah.
And our community will appreciate us because we're going to do something on behalf of the Algerian Muslim community. We're going to get back at those insults that they proclaimed the Prophet Muhammad. So that's the narrative that it emerges in this kind of shroud of mist. As I say, we don't know all the facts yet, but this seems to be one of those cases.
Well, Mark, I want to kind of go piece by piece on what you've talked about in contextualizing the Paris bloodshed among tragedies like Newtown and Aurora, as well as Boston and Oak Creek, as you mentioned. You erase the artificial line that many seem compelled to draw around only events where Islam is referenced. Why is erasing that line essential to understanding these events?
Well, I'm just trying to look at the facts.
And when you look at the facts, you start off with the people who committed the acts. Who are they? Mm-hmm. What were their motives? What was going on in their lives? What is similar in this case? The other cases where angry, lost young men lash out at the world in violent ways.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at it that way, you're stripping the act down to its essentials. And you start off with that, and then you go and say, well, then what kind of excuse did they use? What kind of ideology did they latch onto? In some cases, it was no mm-hmm. secular, it was no ideology. In some cases, it was Christian, in the case of Andres Breivik, or it was kind of skinhead ideology in the case of the guy who attacked the Sikh Gurdwara, or it was Islamic ideology in this case, but that seems to be a secondary issue, not a primary one. Again, I'm just saying this is what appears to be the situation as you look at the facts as we now know them.
Right. And you highlight that the Kouachi brothers were hardly religious at all. And so we see the importance, and then that leads to your observation that religion doesn't cause the violence. It's an excuse for it. So how does understanding that impact the way we work together to discourage future acts of violence?
Well, that means that we should look at the causes and try to reduce the situations that produce the causes. And rather than lash out at the ideology or the religion that people may have used as an excuse for their violence. In the case of this particular case in France, one of the things that produced it was the sense of alienation, the sense that the Muslim community and Islam in general was being insulted, was mm-hmm. being marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely the wrong thing to do would be more Islamophobia, more hatred of Muslims and more suspicion of the Algerian Muslim community. That would simply heighten the kind of conditions that produce this violence in the first place.
Yeah, and it victimizes the other followers of that faith. And, I mean, I think we're seeing that over and over again in different places throughout the world.
Yeah, it produces a kind of vicious cycle where we're in lashing back by, in a sense, reacting against the religion rather than the conditions that cause the situation. You then, as you say, victimize the people who were innocent people who had, no evil intent. But you begin to sense kind of radicalize them.
Mm-hmm.
You produce the opportunity, the kind of we-they narrative, the cosmic war, the battle between cultures that then, produces an opportunity for other people to say, aha, yeah. Well, I am unhappy in my life. I want to take it out on these guys also. Mm-hmm. And so the vicious cycle continues.
And, Mark, I don't have any—
You've got to reduce the cycle of violence.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I don't have any desire to get in line with the those who want to bash the media about everything. But it does seem here, given what your observations, the credibility of your observations, that media reports on instances like this have a responsibility to get it right and not just report on what appears to be, but to ask the questions you've asked and report on what really is going on, so that religion doesn't take the brunt of guilt on all of this.
Yeah, I agree. Although that requires more than a 1 minute headline and a fast moving video clip, it requires a little bit more thoughtful investigation.
Right, right, and frankly, they need your telephone number.
I'm always happy to talk with people, but I've got to tell you, I fight even with members of my own family who say, oh, no, Islam was the problem. Look, that's what they said. The guy the brothers, as they left the attack, said, "We are revenging. We are bringing vengeance against the acting insult against the Prophet Muhammad." Mm-hmm. They've said it themselves. That's all you need to know. Well, yes, they did say it, but that's not all you need to know. You know, people say all kinds of things. They will, if you're involved in an act of violence, this gory, you want to justify it. You want to, maybe it gives you a thrill. Maybe it gives you a sense of power, because a public act of violence is always empowering. You know, it gives you a feeling like you're in control of things. But in order to carry out an act like that, you have to feel that there's some justification. So, of course, they're going to look for some reason, some excuse, something that they think will glorify themselves with this gory act in the minds of some people by bringing on revenge against those who insulted the Prophet Muhammad. So it's a wonderful excuse to be to be violent.
Well, Mark, let me move for just a second before we get off from the specific to the general. Can you take the arguments that we've been talking about here related to these two brothers and make that a general principle related to organizational terror movements like ISIS? Are they really driven by religious beliefs, or are they also hiding behind religion to forward an agenda that is more political and power-based than religious?
From what we know about ISIS, there seems to be at least three different kinds of followers. And again, I'm dealing with the evidence of what we know about the people who join the movement. And a few of them, a very few, are true believers, but even in those cases, it's complicated with other things that are going on in their lives. And the other two categories often overlap with it. The other two categories are Sunni Muslims in Iraq and Syria who feel marginalized, mm-hmm. who feel left out of public life, and they see this as an opportunity to get back in charge. So for them, the motivations are very clear. It's power, pure and simple. And then there are the young people from France and from Europe and from England, from the United States, who seem to be caught up in this grand image of cosmic war, a great battle, a great civilizational battle, which they've seen on the internet and chat rooms and discussed in chat rooms. And they're this kind of glorification of war. It's like a grand computer game. And for them, the thrill of battle and to feel like they are doing something that will ennoble them, and these are particularly people who have been marginalized as immigrant communities, as members of a Muslim community in the United States or UK or Europe. But sometimes they're not even Muslim. They're just people who see that, oh, great, a grand battle, a great war. Look at these guys. They're cutting off heads. They really mean business. They're badass. You know, that kind of sense of macho, which appeals to, unfortunately, a lot of angry young men, becomes the great attraction, the great lure. And often when they get there, they realize that this is really not very glorious at all, and it's pretty dirty and pretty ugly business. And then they try to get out, but it's too late then. They can't get out without being killed, and they can't stay there without killing. It's a pretty awful business. But Those are the categories, and religion plays, even in the case of ISIS, or maybe especially in the case of ISIS, a pretty marginal role.
You know, it strikes me in listening to you that thoughtful people almost need a very brief tutorial in reading reports of events like this, and I want to, based on what you've said to us today, which is so extremely helpful and actually crucial, because if we don't understand what you're telling us, we're trying to offer solutions that don't really address the problems. So what is a very brief one, two, three, or maybe not even that much tutorial in helping people to ask these questions when you hear one of these reports so that you have a chance of getting the interpretation of what happened right? What would you say?
Oh, number one, who's doing it? Number two, why? What's going on in their life? What kind of people, what community are they associated with? What are the variety of motives that may be involved in it? And three, what kind of response is going to help and what kind of response is going to make things worse? And if people are caught up with an image of cosmic war, to come at them with like gangbusters with an army and with more war sometimes fuels the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's exactly what we expected. That's what these people really are like. They really do want to kill Muslims. And it can be used as a recruiting tool to actually, you know, enlarge the movements and to engage more people into radical acts.
Mm. Dr. Mark Juergens-Myers, professor of sociology and director of global and international studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of the book, Terror in the Mind of God, The Global Rise of Religious Violence. His insightful Religious Dispatches article is headlined, Religion Was Not the Reason for the Paris Attacks. I have to tell you, I honestly think that this is one of the more important interviews we've ever done on State of Belief because it can help us be realistic about what's going on in the terrorist world around us. And we badly need to be honest about what's happening so we can be effective in dealing with what's happening. Mark, it's always valuable to have you with us. I'm serious about this being one of the more important interviews we've done. And I thank you for making time once again to put State of Belief on your schedule.
My pleasure.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. A big thank you to listeners who've made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief and share the stories you find compelling with your friends. They may benefit from that. You'll enjoy them listening with you. The same goes for Twitter. We're at twitter.com/stateofbelief. It's a great way for you to be an active part of getting these important voices to reach more people at such a critical time. A time when the noise in social media threatens to drown them out. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Was the son of a preacher man, the only boy who could ever teach me. Was the son of a preacher man, yes he was.